Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood, and Chloe Archard from Paleo Britain. This week, we are being joined by Chris Kelly from Nourish Balance Thrive. I first heard Chris talk on Rob Wolf's podcast a few months ago, and I was surprised because he was a Brit, which was nice to hear. And then he was talking about doing some free consulting, and I actually hit him up for one of his free consultations just so we could talk about how he did his training and how he learned what he knows. And what he's going to talk with us about today is gut health and the various things you can do for your gut health. And if you heard me speak at Health Unplugged recently, then you'll know that I mentioned his name because I knew that he was available for people if they had any issues and he could talk to them, at least get a free, consultation for free to begin with. And I know at least one person who spoke to him and they were really happy with the advice that they got. So Chris is going to join us to talk about the gut. But Chris, why don't you first just give us a bit of an intro about yourself and how you got to where you are?
Sure. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on. Yeah, so like you say, I'm British. I was living in London before I moved to California. I'm in Santa Cruz in California right now. And I've been in California for over 10 years now. And bicycle racing is my thing. I'm a really big biker. And when I moved to California, I got super competitive with mountain biking. This is, you know, the birthplace of mountain biking. It seemed rude not to do it. And so I started doing bike racing. And within a couple of years, I would say, my health completely fell apart. Like, I just really, really fell apart. So what I mean by this is I wasn't sleeping through the night anymore. I had all kinds of weird, what I now know to be hypoglycemic episodes. And my blood sugar was all over the place. And so my energy was all over the place. And my sex drive had completely disappeared. And I had all kinds of digestive complaints. So all manner of bloating and stomach pain, and certain foods seemed to make things a lot worse. And so I did what anyone would do, and I went to the doctor. I was working for a quantitative hedge fund in Walnut Creek in California at the time, and they provided me with private health insurance, which was, I thought, fantastic at the time. And I went to my GP, and the GP prescribed me a bunch of medications that would help with each one of the individual symptoms that I presented with, which can be useful sometimes, but in this instance, it didn't really answer the question, why on earth is this happening? And he then just passed the buck and sent me to a gastroenterologist. And the gastroenterologist wasn't interested in what I was eating at all, thought it was nothing to do with it, told me I was fine, and suggested that I do a colonoscopy. And then if that confirms what I'd already just told her, which was that I had irritable bowel syndrome, then they could prescribe me some corticosteroids. And then if that didn't work, or when that stopped working, then they could do some surgery to remove parts of my gut. Okay. So obviously this is pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And the girl that I recently met at that time, who's now my wife, is a food scientist. And she'd not long graduated from university with a master's degree in food science. And she was like, no, this is not right. She'd spent a lot of time in the lab studying microbiology and looking at food sensitivities and allergies. And she's like, no, this is not right. And so she did some research, and we were already eating. Like, I'd seen some improvement by switching to a paleo type diet, but her research turned up something called the autoimmune paleo protocol. Yep. And I think that was popularized. I think it was actually Rob Wolf that originally, it was called the autoimmune caveat in his book, which is quite old now. But I would say that Sarah Ballantyne, the paleomom.com, really popularized this diet. Yeah. And we thought, well, what the heck? You know, what have we really got to lose? It sounds a lot less invasive than these steroids or surgery. And so we gave it a try. And within 2 weeks, I was a completely changed person. It was absolutely transformational. It was really, truly amazing. And then, of course, that got me wondering, or got us wondering, what else is possible. And we were already pretty thick in the research by then anyway, and I just happened to stumble across a functional medicine practitioner. So this is a different type of doctor. In fact, he wasn't even a doctor at all. The person I found was actually a chiropractor, which I was incredibly skeptical about. But I did his tests anyway, because some of the things that he said to me really resonated. And it was almost like he was a magician. Like, I called him up and said, you know, what's going on here? Why is the autoimmune protocol working so well? And he said, well, you've been through this increased period of stress, which is the bike racing, probably. And then what that's done is it's lowered your immunity, and you've picked up an infection. And now that infection is keeping you sick, and you need to get rid of that infection in order to get better. And I did a bunch of saliva and urine and stool testing. And like I say, everything he said turned out to be true. I had a pinworm infection, so like a childhood sort of pinworm thing. You don't normally see this in adults. Mm-hmm. And then some more sort of weird amoeba thing, and a general overgrowth of bad bacteria. And so, you know, once I solved all those problems, and they were all perfectly solvable, you can take nutritional supplements, like not even any prescription medicines. I took one prescription med to solve the problems that he found on the lab work. And it was utterly transformational again, the experience. And I started doing better in all walks of life. I'd always been pretty good on the bike, but, you know, I started doing better at work and socially, and I had depression at the time, and that lifted completely, and some of my anxiety went away. So it was a really life-changing experience. And I thought, well, you know, I've just got to know how this works. And so I persuaded this guy to let me onto his training course that's designed for medical doctors and other licensed practitioners, and he agreed to let us on because my wife's a food scientist. And you know, it's not that different from computer science. Like, it's like kind of you have to read some stuff and understand it and think for yourself and do some research, and that's what we did. And we started testing some of our friends and family, and started to find some of the same things that I'd had problems with, and it sort of branched out from there. And then that Rob Wolf podcast was kind of what launched it all, really. I did that one, and I did Ben Greenfield's, and met a medical doctor, and we started a new practice, and that's what Nourish Balance Thrive is now. It's like helping people that have had some of the same problems with mostly diet and lifestyle intervention, and then we've got these lab tests that can reveal some root causes of some really common health complaints, and we've been getting fantastic results. It's been really, really fun.
Great. One thing that I noticed, and Chloe probably noticed when she was with me at Health Unplugged, sort of at the first paleo conference in the UK, was that a lot of people are very good at, you know, they've done the basics and they've read the blog posts and they've done a bit of digging. And a lot of people, particularly when it comes to gut health, they really start to struggle, and then they kind of run out of information. And then they're not really sure what to do next, particularly in the UK, because we don't have the same kind of access to people and tests as you do in the US. Mm-hmm. So that's what hopefully you'll sort of start to enlighten us a bit about on. And I know that Chloe, as usual, has her list of questions. So I think she can just sort of get going and we'll hopefully give people some good tips as to what they can start to do.
Sounds good.
Yeah, no, it's so fascinating listening to your story, because I hadn't heard any of that before. And I just think that it's really interesting, firstly, because one of the things about gut health, I think, is that people, a lot of people that come to the paleo diet come to it because they have digestive issues. And right. They're sort of Googling, thinking, what can I do? And they come across the paleo diet, and that's sort of how they come to it. So I think a lot of people that maybe will be listening into this podcast have had digestive issues or still do. And one of the things I think is quite interesting as well is that people think they'll try paleo and that will help, and actually sometimes it doesn't. And that's probably for some of the reasons that you've been talking about, like perhaps people have other issues like infections that they didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And things like that. So if I just kind of go back to the beginning and start with some of the questions I had, and then we'll obviously go through all of this as we chat. Okay. One of my first questions was, I listened to a talk recently about gut health, and they said that there can be these specific issues affecting our digestion that we might not even be aware of. And the first thing they talked about was stomach acid. And I thought this was really interesting, because most people, especially if you think about how many products there are out there, like Gaviscon and Rennie's and all these antacids, most people think that they have a problem with excess stomach acid. And in this talk, they were saying, actually, most people don't have a problem with excess stomach acid. People have low stomach acid on the whole, or not everybody, but some people suffer with low stomach acid. But, you know, they're taking these over-the-counter drugs thinking that they're going to help, and they're actually making the problem worse. So, yeah, what's the issue with that? because I say a lot of people do think they have this kind of problem with excess stomach acid.
Yeah, you need to figure out what's causing that. There's a reason why you've got low stomach acid, and you need to figure it out, right? So it could be you've got an infection. So one that we're seeing a lot of recently is H. pylori, and I say we're seeing it recently, and the reason we're seeing it a lot more is because the lab that we're using recently upgraded their test. So it's really difficult to test for H. pylori or any infection in blood. I should start by prefixing. So, you know, sometimes people, like I did, for example, I went to my doctor and he just tried to test me for H. pylori in blood, and the antibodies may or may not still be there depending on how long you've had the infection and various other different things. So that's kind of sketchy. So the reason this is related to stomach acid is this bacteria has the ability to lower the acidity of the stomach, and it does so for its own devices. And previously nobody thought that anything could live in the stomach, and two Australian scientists quite famously won the Nobel Prize for proving otherwise, and that stomach ulcers were actually caused by this bacteria. So it's quite a famous story that people can go Google and read about. It's quite really, really interesting. Everybody thought they were quacks, and they turned out to win the Nobel Prize. But yeah, so we're seeing a lot of that. We do a stool test on someone. It comes back and they've got this infection. And, you know, once you know what's there, it's not actually that difficult to get rid of. You can take some botanical herbs, or you can go to the doctor and get some antibiotics. And you'll then see that, you know, like once you remove that cause, that the stomach acid is just going to return to normal levels. And then also something you have to think about is certain nutrients are required to produce hydrochloric acid. And so you've got this catch-22 or this vicious cycle created where you've got an infection and it's lowering the acidity of the stomach, and then that's affecting your ability to digest, absorb, assimilate nutrients from your food, and then that in turn leads to the low stomach acid. So it's kind of a nasty vicious cycle that you need to break. But yeah, that's my kind of my direct answer to the question is figure it out. Like, there's a reason why you've got low stomach acid. It's not just bad luck, and it's not because you forgot to take a proton pump inhibitor. It's something else is going on.
And actually taking something like Gaviscon or a proton pump inhibitor, again, increases your risk of H. pylori infection. So even if you don't have it already, you might get it later on because you're taking those medications. And I think a reason why people are getting these symptoms of things like heartburn is because the valve between the stomach and the esophagus, your food pipe, essentially, there's obviously there's a door there which should be closed, and that door is closed by high acidity in the stomach. So if you don't have enough stomach acid, the door isn't closed, and then you get reflux up, and then you get the symptoms. So it's not because you have too much; it's actually because you have too little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of these drugs you need to look into is like the proton pump inhibitors. They weren't designed for long-term use. So I'll meet people that have been on these things for years, but when you look at the drug, it was never designed to be used for 2 years. It was designed to be used for 2 weeks, and so that can cause a problem. And then when people, like, they'll read something on the internet and they'll just stop it cold turkey, and then they get the most terrible rebound, you know, where, like, you know, you really do have too much acid because of the suppression effect. And so you have to watch out for that too.
It's also just really it's really difficult because my sister was suffering from sort of heartburn and acid reflux, and she's only 21, and she only had it for a couple of weeks, went to the doctor, and straight away they prescribed her proton pump inhibitors. And I just said to her, no, don't take them, just sort of, you know, kind of try and eat a bit better for the next couple of weeks and just see how things go. And it went away and she was absolutely fine, but the doctor was just so quick to prescribe that for her. And I think the trouble is people go and they just get prescribed these things, start taking them, and that's it. And then it leads to all sorts of other problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing you have to understand, and maybe this process is slightly different in the UK. I'm not certainly an expert on it in the UK, but here in the US, the medical doctor I'm partnered with, Dr. Bush, she is a primary care physician. So that's what you call a general practitioner or a GP in the UK. And her practice is set up so that her day is divided into 20-minute time slots. And at the end of that time slot, she's supposed to write a prescription. That's her toolkit, is like the prescription pad. She can't recommend the paleo diet. That's not a cure for any disease. You can't use that in that way, right? She doesn't, or even if she did want to do that, she doesn't have the time to explain to someone how to eat a nutrient-dense paleo diet or how to protect their photoperiod or do any of the diet and lifestyle coaching. And so it's not surprising then that when you go to the doctor and you present with some symptoms that you walk away with a prescription.
And in the UK, that time is can be as low as 7 minutes.
Okay, it's worse.
So, that's good to know. So when you're talking about, you know, 20 minutes would be a luxury for most GPs in the UK. And the problem is that when you're coming in with heartburn symptoms, they really are their first line treatment, other than, you know, wait 2 weeks and come back if it hasn't stopped, is a proton pump inhibitor. And, you know, testing for things like H. pylori will happen a lot further down the road if things aren't getting any better.
Yeah, I should make it clear actually that the problem is not the doctors. I'm sure the doctors are all really, really smart people. The problem is the system.
Yeah.
Like whoever decided that 7 minutes was a reasonable amount of time to help someone just got it wrong.
Absolutely.
Now it's quite deeply ingrained into the system. And also the pharmacological solutions, the prescriptions that are being written are the main driving force of the business. And so you've got yourself a real problem changing this, right? Like nobody's going to make rich. I've quit my job at the hedge fund now and we do this full time. But, you know, we're really struggling to make this a business because there's not really any money in diet and lifestyle coaching, right? And I'm sure that the doctors and everybody else in the medical industry or healthcare industry have thought about this, right? It's difficult.
And the other thing that's also difficult here is because people don't have the medical insurance, a lot of people can't afford to go for private testing. Mm-hmm. So you're a bit stuck because your only option often is the GP or Googling it and trying to see what you can do by, you know, finding things out yourself online. I think states it's different because people do have the medical insurance, so they can then, you know.
Yeah, so let me say something about how that works. In the US, a lot of people have healthcare insurance, but it's not actually that useful in many cases. So, you know, when I worked for the hedge funds, I had this, what they call PPO insurance, which is like the very best insurance you can get. But still, you would have to pay some percentage of the cost of each treatment or each doctor's visit.
Right.
And you would never know what that's going to be. So you could go and see a specialist and then decide to bill you for $700 for an hour. And then your insurance might randomly choose to reject that. And so you didn't know that you were in for $700 when you went to go and see this guy. And now you're lumbered with this bill. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes it can be, if you have like a life-threatening emergency, if you crash your mountain bike and you end up with a collapsed lung and in hospital for a week, then it can save you from having to pay out for like a $150,000 bill. And that I don't think would ever happen in the UK. But for anything that's chronic, so if you've got a problem that's been going on for longer than a couple of weeks, say, or a couple of months maximum, then the insurance is actually more harm than it is good, I think.
Yeah. So there's kind of pros and cons to both, really.
Yeah. You need disaster recovery. That's what you need in the UK. You're lucky that you get that in the UK for nothing.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go back to my questions. So other than low stomach acid, another thing they talked about in this talk I listened to was digestive enzymes as well. So they were saying that low digestive enzymes could also cause problems.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so absolutely. Like it's going back to that same problem where digestive enzymes are proteins and they need certain nutrients in place. When you look at the biochemistry, and I'm sure Tommy will be able to speak to this much better than I can, you're synthesizing a new protein and various different things have to be in place in order for that pathway to work. And if they are missing because your digestion's not working very well, you'll just naturally be low on the enzymes that you need to make the enzymes. It's like a horrible vicious cycle. What do you think that's right, Tommy?
I mean, it must be. I think it will be a combination of nutrient deficiencies and then also whatever else is going on has prevented is sort of preventing that pathway taking place. And I think in a lot of people those kinds of things will come down to chronic stress or chronic inflammation, because, you know, the havoc that they can play in terms of actually the body being able to regulate normal protein function and metabolism is absolutely huge. But what I'd ask you is what kind of, so are you seeing people with low digestive enzymes? Like what kind of symptoms are they getting? What kind of problems are they getting? Or is that something that you haven't really had much in your practice?
No, we do. And usually, you know, the two most commonly taken supplements that I you know, find people taking are betaine HCl, which, so this is hydrochloric acid, so like fake stomach acid, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And then the digestive enzymes, and people have already found that gives them some benefit. Like they notice the difference. Like they just digest food; it doesn't sit, you know, in their stomach in the same way. They don't find that they still feel full, you know, 2 or 3 hours after they ate dinner or something like that. So, yeah, that's really, really common. I don't actually have. Actually, that's not strictly true. One of the Genova stool tests that we does look at pancreatic enzymes, but. You know, the thing that I'm going after is rather than, you know, I see this as a symptom, and rather than going after the symptom, I'm going after the root causes. And then when you remove the root causes, so say that person had an H. pylori infection, or say they had a Cryptosporidium infection, or say they had a C. difficile infection, or something else going on, then if you can detect and remove that infection, then you remove, like the gut will just heal by itself. And the digestive enzyme problem will just go away by its own accord.
Okay, so you think it is really important that if anyone is suffering from any kind of digestive complaint, that they should really go and have these specific tests done, rather than just trying to sort of improve their diet and see if things get better?
No, not at all. So I work with quite a specific group of people, and it's not my choice. It's just the way things have worked out. So... And the reason is because of the places where I've been talking. So the Rob Wolf podcast, Ben Greenfield, Jimmy Moore, the low carb expert. Some other people that are quite famous in the paleo and low carb blogospheres.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the people that come to me, they're like, oh, well, I've been following Ben Greenfield for 2 years and I've done everything he's told me to do on his podcast. And I've gotten fantastic results with all of it. So I'm thinking that this must be the same. Like I'm in, you know, and of course, they've already done all the hard part. Like I get everybody to switch over to some type of paleo diet. Everybody I speak to is sensitive to gluten. And I'm not saying that everybody in the world is sensitive to gluten. I'm saying everybody I speak to is sensitive to gluten. And so they've done most of the hard work. And usually they understand most of the other lifestyle factors like stress management and protecting their photoperiod and circadian rhythm. But sometimes they don't. So sometimes I have a few little tidbits for them there. So for these people that have already been doing all of this really good and essential work, then the lab testing really comes into its own just to reveal that missing piece that you couldn't possibly have known about had you not done the test.
Mm. Okay. You know, that's really interesting. And it's one of the things that really fascinates me because I've been following the paleo diet for a couple of years now and I'm obviously really interested in health and do sort of all the things I can. And it's just something that you sometimes think that, like you say, that missing piece of the puzzle where you just think you want to have these tests done just to know if there's anything else that is going on that you could be, you know, sorting out. So it interests me from that point of view. one of the other questions that I had, so you know, you hear quite a lot of people talking about the gut bacteria and gut dysbiosis. So what is actually gut dysbiosis?
So we know that some bacteria do some really useful things for us. And we know that other bacteria are not so good. So, you know, going back to an example that I gave already. So H. pylori, obviously, C. difficile is a gram-positive spore-forming bacteria that when stressed, it releases two types or many different types of toxin, two of which I can test for on a stool test, and it makes people really sick. So in the US, 14,000 people each year die of this infection, and I think most of them are a lot more frail than the people that I see. But nevertheless, it's a serious condition, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to treat with antibiotics. And so, you know, this is something, clearly an example of a bacteria that's not helping us in our gut. And so I would say a dysbiosis then is more of these bad bacteria or bad microbes. So there are other things which are not bacteria but are small enough to live in our gut. So protozoan organisms, very small organisms or microbes. And so when you have more of the bad guys than you do of the good guys, or just even an overgrowth of the good guys can do like the same damage, then you start to see like pathology. So the gut just doesn't work as well as it should. And then you see downstream effects of that, like the insufficiency of the enzymes that we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, okay. And so what is the best way for people to approach gut dysbiosis and to try and improve the balance of bacteria in the gut? What's the best way to go about that?
Yeah, so the testing, you know, it really comes into its own for this reason. Because first of all, you have to know that it's there, right? So the new types of testing that's coming out, so this is a really rapidly evolving area of science. And there's a company, a lab in the US called Genova Diagnostics that have a new PCR DNA stool test. So PCR DNA, this is the technology that forensic scientists use to identify evidence at a crime scene. And they can now use this same technology to identify bacteria or microbes right down to the species level. So this is quite new, this type of technology. And then also what they can do is once they've cultured some of these microbes or the ones that they think are causing a problem that are known pathogens, they can actually do an additional experiment where they test the bugs to see what types of antibiotics or what types of botanical herbs they're susceptible or resistant to. And so once you have this information, you can design an awesome protocol that's going to like kill the bad guys and hopefully leave as many of the good guys as possible. So to give you an example, my own example, when I started doing the testing, it showed quite clearly that I had an overgrowth of all of the bacteria. I was just blown up like a balloon every time I ate any kind of carbohydrate, including fiber or fermented foods, all of these things that we know should be good. I just blew up like a balloon and it was agony. And I ended up just pressing the reset button on my entire gut microbiota. So I just took a bunch of botanical herbs, things like oregano oil and golden seal and noni is another of these sort of tropical herbs, and it just basically wiped out all of the bacteria, and I felt a normal level of bloating for the first time in my entire life, which I can tell you was quite an emotional experience. It's so strange. And then afterwards I just concentrated on building up a more healthy flora with things like probiotics and fermented foods, and you know, the problem never came back. You know, I was so worried that when I stopped taking the supplements, then, you know, the problem would just go back. And it didn't. I'm like as good today as I ever was. So, yeah, I know there's a solution.
Did you get, okay, a lot of people talk about a die-off effect when they start taking strong botanicals. Did you get anything like that? Like feeling like flu-like symptoms because you were suddenly killing off this huge population of bacteria in your gut all in one go? Did you feel anything like that?
Yeah, but it might be for different reasons. So I was kind of like, I know like what works and what doesn't now. And I was kind of nuts at the time. I was really into the mountain bike racing still. I mean, I still am. I'm racing at the highest level. I'm a pro mountain biker. And at the time I took these supplements. I was actually doing a 7-day stage race across Canada on my mountain bike. So racing every day for like between 3 and 4 hours. And I brought all these supplements across the Canadian border. I was like, kind of felt really nervous about it, even though I know they were just food supplements and there was no problem with any of it. But yeah, so I was stuffing, choking down all these capsules every day. And it was insane. Like all this stuff came out of me. There was all kinds of different colors and it was weird. But yeah, no, I didn't experience anything. Like I've certainly in our practice, that's one of the chief complaints with one of these protocols is people start too quickly and then these bacteria, or especially the yeast as well, I think they can give off toxins as they become distressed or start dying.
Yeah.
And if that person has a leaky gut, so increased intestinal permeability, which is characteristic of this dysbiosis, then you find that some of these toxins end up in the bloodstream, and then you have like horrible symptoms of fatigue or brain fog, or maybe you get a skin rash or something like that. It does happen, but it doesn't last.
Okay. And so you just mentioned there the increased intestinal permeability or leaky gut that we hear loads about. And there's still a lot of people that I see saying this is just all pseudoscience, it's a load of rubbish, it doesn't really exist. And Tommy, I don't know what you think about that, the whole leaky gut thing.
I guess, Chris, you can kind of speak to how, I mean, do you ever test for that or do you just assume that it's going on when people have when people have this kind of, you just do the stool test for parasites or test for overgrowth and then just assume that they've probably got some leaky gut going on at the same time?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't understand. I mean, I've not actually seen that. I'd love to kind of see some like respectable people that are still questioning the idea of increased intestinal permeability. I think, you know, you might be able to, like, if I went back to my primary care physician, he would probably, like, look at me funny. But that's because that guy, you know, he went through medical school in the 80s and he's never opened a textbook since, right? So, you know, some of this stuff is really quite new.
I know that certainly doctors of my generation in the UK or you know, so people who qualified fairly recently, they would still, you know, this is something either they haven't heard of or something that they don't really believe in, despite the fact that, I mean, how you test for it, you know, differs from place to place. But, you can definitely give inert substances into the gut and then they shouldn't cross the gut and then they end up in the bloodstream. So the only way they got there is because there's permeability there, which there are holes in the gut that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, exactly. So Genova do have this same lab that I mentioned earlier. They do have an intestinal permeability test. And so they basically, it works by exactly how you just described. So they give you some, ingest some molecule which is too big to end up in the bloodstream. And yet somehow it does, right? So they test it and they say, okay, so that's there. So it's like, that's, something's up here. But I don't actually run that test because when you, like you said, you can make that assumption. So when you see somebody that's got dysbiosis and maybe they've got a parasite and they've been under a ton of stress and, you know, they just tick all the or touch all the buttons for each one of these things we know causes leaky gut, then you can just assume it. And my experience has been that once you remove the offending items, so things like food and potential, you know, bad bugs or these parasites, then the gut will just heal itself and the problem for the most part is going to go away by itself.
Okay.
I think one thing we were going to, I know we're going to pick your brains on some of the things that the extra things people can do on at home, maybe before they reach out to somebody and try and get tested if they think they need something. But one thing that I was interested in, you're talking about your mountain bike racing and obviously you're trying to treat a gut dysbiosis and do a seven-day mountain bike race at the same time. So that leads to a question that I know we had, which is how people mitigate maybe the effects of stress on their gut. Because I mean, you have a high stress if you're a pro mountain biker. So that your gut is under a high amount of stress, and people are going to be under a high amount of stress. And that might be what sort of led them down the route of gut problems in the first place. So how do you think people should mitigate some of those problems of stress and how it can affect the gut?
Don't do that. That works. It's like, you know, when, you know, I'm poking myself in the eye with a pencil and it hurts. So what do I do about that? Yeah. No, seriously. So that, I mean, that's kind of our niche. So the medical doctor that I'm partnered with is also a professional mountain biker and she's a real pro. So I'm a hobby pro, which means I do it as a hobby. And she's actually racing UCI World Cups and... Wow. Trying to make a living. She works part-time as a doctor. So, yeah, she's a real pro. And, yeah, I mean, you just have to mitigate the harmful effects as best you can. And the first thing you need to understand is that when you do endurance or aerobic exercise, that's like an ischemic injury to your gut. And what ischemic means is, like, without blood. So you're actually diverting the blood supply away from the gut towards the exercising muscles. And so that's going to create all types of problems from your poor gut that's trying to digest food and move things along and absorb nutrients. Like, it's just all going to go wrong. And so, you know, you can think of this as a budget and you just blew the whole thing on endurance exercise. So that gives me in particular very little wiggle room for any kind of food that's going to potentially also cause a problem for your gut. So a great example is with the bike racing is there's almost this Roach Coach taco truck that appears at the start finish line of every bike race. And it sells these nasty kind of corn tortilla things wrapped in rice and beans and rancid omega 6 oils and some GMO corn fed beef. And, you know, if I was to eat one of those things, it would take me out on the best of days. But at that particular moment when I just finished a bike race, that would be a really, really terrible time to eat something like that. So I just have to be, you know, back onto the autoimmune protocol. We know which foods are going to potentially cause you problems. And if you stick to those when you know that you're susceptible, then you're going to have a much better outcome than if you just, you know, carried on as normal.
And is there anything else? I mean, so I've spoken to some people who have some kind of chronic gut problem. Some of them have something like an inflammatory bowel disease, like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's. And I think that endurance exercise is really killer for those kind of people, particularly for that reason. But what about things like sleep and stuff? How can you make sure you're getting the best out of that? Is there anything specific that you do or you tell people to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I should add one more thing, right? That's so, so important that I realised I did, that other people can do. So if you're a runner or a biker or a swimmer or something, you're doing one of these endurance sports, then it's really, really crucial that you become fat adapted, right? So what this means is you have the ability to use fat as fuel for your endurance activity. And the reason is most people, when they run or bike, they're using glucose as a substrate to produce energy. So they're using sugar. And the problem with that is you don't have very much sugar. And so you have to eat. And so you've seen this at the local half marathon or whatever, people choking down the Clif bars and the gels and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah.
And all of that, or most of it, is not good for your blood sugar, not good for your gut, not good for the microbiota that live in your gut. And it's really going to cause you problems in the long term. And so if you can switch over to a more fat-based metabolism, so when you're eating a high-fat diet and you're able to tap into your stored body fat for use in endurance activity, that's going to mean that you just don't have to eat so much food. So like when I go for a 6-hour bike ride now, I won't eat anything at all. Like I'll just drink plain water and maybe take some electrolytes or some free-form amino acids, and that's it. And so, you know, during that time where my gut has had its blood supply removed, I'm not trying to cram more food down there, yeah. If that makes sense. So that can be important too, or at least it's turned out to be really important for me. So yeah, going back to your question, yeah, absolutely. So there's some things that I figured out that all humans need. And the lab testing is really good at picking out individuality and identifying a particular person's problems. But I know that, you know, we've already talked about diet. The sleep part is just crucial. Like you could be doing everything right. You could be eating the most perfect paleo diet. But if you're only getting 6.5 hours of sleep every night, I just don't see how you could be a person in the modern world and survive that. And so, you know, I spend tons of time. And then I work with a registered nurse and she's awesome at all this biohacking stuff as well. So we spend tons of time with people making them understand the difference between a light and a dark cycle and how important sleep is and how their bedroom should look and all of this good stuff.
And do you have any specific, you know, if we're trying to give people actionable tips, do you have any sort of the most important things that people can easily do, say, to make sure they're getting a good light-dark cycle or make sure they're getting that kind of stuff right?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough at this time of year, you know. Like, so if you're living in the UK right now, I would say that you have zero ability to produce vitamin D from the sun. And the days are so short, it's really going to screw with this circadian rhythm. And this is obvious, by the way. Just look at people's faces as you get onto the tube on the London Underground on a Monday morning, right? Like people are pretty miserable. Whereas, you know, I'm hearing, I don't mean to rub it in. It sounds like I'm boasting now. I probably am, but I'll say anyway. Yeah, it's a beautiful sunny day here in California and the light is streaming through this window. And, you know, that is when that light hits my eyes, that's sending a signal to my brain that it's daytime. And when that signal is removed, that's when my brain says, okay, it's now nighttime. And so I'm going to produce a sleep hormone called melatonin. And that hormone is going to put you to sleep. And so your brain can get really confused and things can get all out of whack with other hormones if you don't have this light dark signal. So what I get people to do, you know, not everybody's lucky enough to live in California, and some of the people I work with are way far north than me. And so I have them try and recreate that environment artificially. So when they get up in the morning, you know, if they can get outside and walk the dog and it's light, then that's good enough. But if that's not going to happen, then, you know, for example, I'm at a desk here and I've got a lighting strip. I can send you the link for this. You can buy these things on Amazon here in the US. And it's just an LED lighting strip, and you can adjust the different colours that it shines at you. And so at the moment, I've got this on a bright blue, and it's just kind of on top of the sunlight. It's actually streaming blue light onto my chin.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of the day, you know, the days are pretty short here in California too. So at 5 o'clock, it's going to be pretty dark. And so I'll just switch that blue colour to a red colour, which is, so the blue is important. It's the blue component of the light that's sending this signal to the pineal gland in the brain that it's daytime. And so I remove that blue component of the light, and then I can do the same on my computer screen. If I'm still typing emails, you can get this application called f.lux that you can install on your computer.
Yeah, I've got
and
that.
It automatically adjusts the color of the screen as when the sun goes down. And so you can take away that blue component of the light. And sometimes people get fantastic results. You know, they come to me, their main complaint is insomnia. And they do these things, they hack their environment, and they get better sleep that way. And of course, the sleep affects everything. You might have someone with hormone imbalance, but that's secondary to the fact that they're not sleeping.
So before we get and we get back to Chloe can take over again and get back to her questions, I'm sorry, I keep on interrupting, but because we were talking about sleep, and so getting back that light dark cycle, so something like efflux, do you get people to wear blue blocking glasses or anything? Do you see any benefit in that?
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of the last resort. The blue blocking glasses, you can just go onto amazon.co.uk and find these. They're like $6 or something, and they're just safety glasses that are tinted amber.
Yeah.
So they perform this same task, which is to remove the blue component from the light. Now, I think the problem with these are that, you know, maybe you should not be like doing whatever it is that is exposing you. And I suppose this is the same with the computer too. Like, should you really be reading your iPad at 11 o'clock at night in bed? Or is that going to interfere with your circadian rhythm for other reasons? So we've got this blue light problem. And then you've got this other problem, which is you're sending this stimulating message to your brain, which it's associating with daytime. So maybe, like, the problem is not you need some blue light blocking glasses, but you need to stop watching TV so late,
or you need to stop
reading your iPad in bed. But yeah, I mean, they can be very helpful if your house, what I get people to do is change some of the bulbs for the orange variety, right? So rather than having a ton of white bulbs in your, or blue light bulbs in your house, just replace some of them with the orange component.
And what about, just very finally, do you have any particular supplement protocols or, you know, things that people can easily buy that maybe could sort of balance them out a little bit if they're having issues with their sleep that you think is sort of safe to recommend for most people?
Let me think. You know, like, I'm just trying to think if there's something that I recommend. I mean, in general, as a rule, I don't recommend supplementation without knowing that you need it. And yeah, one of the few ways I know to really know that you need something is to do a test.
Okay.
So everything we do is very quantified. And, you know, you can do more harm than good with some of these. So I'll give you an example that was incredibly beneficial for me in my sleep is I took two amino acids. One was tyrosine and the other one was 5-HTP. And 5-HTP is a precursor to serotonin and melatonin, the sleep hormone. So this is like a calming, inhibitory, soothing neurotransmitter and a sleep hormone. And again, I nearly cried the first time I took it because I just slept like a baby. It was amazing. And of course, all kinds of magic started then. But, you know, I did that after I'd done a urinary organic acid test that showed that I had very low turnover of serotonin. So it didn't measure serotonin directly, I should make that clear. It just looked at the turnover of serotonin, the metabolites of it, like the exhaust gases of serotonin.
Yeah.
And there were none there.
Okay.
And so at that point, it's like, okay, I can probably benefit from taking this as a supplement and get good results. And I did. It was fantastic. So yeah, that's one example.
Great.
Do you want me to go back to
I've stopped interrupting you now, so you can keep going.
I've only got a few more now. So one of the things that's interesting you're saying about the supplements, you don't generally recommend supplements unless people know they need them, which I think is really important because obviously the supplement industry is just crazy and there's just so much out there and people take all sorts of things, not really knowing if it's doing them any good or not. But one of the things is probiotic supplements are obviously sort of touted as being great for everyone. And so do you recommend that everybody takes probiotic supplements, even people that are healthy and don't have problems with their gut? Is that going to be beneficial? Or do you only recommend probiotic supplements, again, if you've had tests and know that you need them?
Yeah, actually, so, you know, there are some exceptions. I think, especially for people like me, right? So, you know, I'm a mountain biker, small business owner, and I think I probably have a much higher demand than many people on this planet for some of the micronutrients. And so a really good quality multivitamin, I think I'm going to benefit from that. And I think people like me are going to benefit from it. So that's what I recommend to pretty much everyone. There's a number of companies that make really great multivitamins. So I recommend those. And then also things like fish oil, the evidence is just overwhelming that these are beneficial for a number of reasons. And so at the very least, people should be trying to eat more cold water fatty fish, which is actually very easy in the UK compared to what it is in the US. Here in the US, really, most supermarkets only sell tuna and salmon, which are great, but there's nothing like the variety you get at, say, you know, Billingsgate Fish Market or something. It's like I couldn't even name like a quarter of the fish there. So, yeah, no, you have it much better there. But if you can't do that or you don't like fish or whatever, then the fish oil I recommend. But, yeah, probiotics are interesting. And, again, I still take a probiotic now, and I tend to switch up which one because I know that more variety is better. But I think those, again, are pretty – it's like a bit of an insurance policy. You know, it's safe to take those. But I should say that in the beginning, I couldn't take a probiotic. Like, even – you know, I would break open a capsule and just take an eighth of a probiotic pill and it would just blow me up like a balloon. It was crazy. So, you know, that's one of my chief complaints. People come to me with bloating and they say, yeah, I tried a probiotic and it didn't work. Like, don't tell me to take probiotics.
But that's often because people, there's one of, so they might have an overgrowth of a good bacteria that's causing a lot of the problem. And that's actually one of the bacteria that's in the probiotic. So you're just taking more of the bacteria that's causing the problem in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, exactly. You can have too many of the bad guys or just too many in total. And so adding more, it's like adding gas to the fire in a way. Now the one exception I've seen to this is a probiotic, which I'm not sure you can get in the UK. And it's called Prescriptasis. It's a soil-based organism.
You can get it online. I know people who
you
have
can get it over here, but I was actually looking at it the other day, and it's like £42 for one bottle. So it's
it's expensive. It's $50 in the US actually for 60. So yeah, it's really expensive. But I've never seen anybody respond badly to that probiotic.
Mm.
And so yeah, that's definitely, if you're going to take anything and you're sensitive, then I would definitely recommend Prescriptasis.
And what about something like some of the fermented foods like kefir that's a good source of probiotics? Do they compare to a supplement, or are they not anywhere near as good?
I think they can be better in some instances, right? So I've seen some evidence that homemade sauerkraut, for example, is a much more dense source of good bacteria than some of the supplements that you'll see on the shelf in the supermarket. But of course, not everybody's up for making those, and it's kind of sketchy in that you don't really know what's in there, right? It could be mold, for all you know, which is not going to help you. So, again, this is another one of those things that when I first started, I was super sensitive. I couldn't even eat a single, like I can remember eating a single strand of sauerkraut, like really finely shredded sauerkraut, and it had a terrible effect on me. And it gave me histamine allergies. That was one of the things I was suffering from, was hay fever. That since went away. And I'm sure the reason it went away is because I changed completely the gut microbiota. So the bacteria are just completely different. And bacteria are involved in producing or breaking down histamine, which can cause some of the allergy symptoms. So, yeah, that was a real problem for me in the beginning. But now I'm fine. I can eat any amount of sauerkraut and it doesn't do anything to me. So, yeah, I think those foods can be like maybe harmful in the beginning and then really helpful later on in keeping a better, more healthy, more diverse microbiota than without that food at all.
So for somebody that's healthy and doesn't have any problems, it's just, you know, following a paleo diet or a real foods diet, just wanting to just generally be living well, you would think that probiotic foods actually are just as good as supplements.
Yeah, I think so. Although I would say something about that. Yesterday I interviewed the CEO of a new probiotic manufacturer, and that was one of their stated goals was, this is ridiculous. All these probiotics, they are produced from substrates that make it easy to do the manufacturing process, right? So that's how they selected the particular strain of bacteria that's in the probiotic. And usually those substrates are dairy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's not kind of like, we know that the ancestral health framework is a very useful device for guiding us in our decision making if we want to be more healthy, and that's just not the type of microbes that we would have been eating in the past. And so what they've done is they've sequenced the genome of the microbiome of 300 individuals that were very closely examined, and they looked at how healthy these people were, and they classified all these bugs, and they decided which were pathogens and which were helpful. And then they did some more analysis, and they said, oh, well, this guy's really sick and this guy's much healthy. And they basically calculated what they call the delta. So this is just the difference between the healthy and the non-healthy, and selected the particular strains of bacteria that are in their probiotic based on that research. It was all funded by the NIH, which is a huge institution in the US, a multi-million dollar project. And that product's called Equilibrium, which I think is even less likely to be available than the UK, the prescriptive cyst, unfortunately. But it's coming, it is coming.
Okay, and just the last couple of questions then. So you've mentioned prescriptive cyst as a probiotic, but you mentioned a couple of other supplements, but if people don't want to go down the route immediately of getting tested, well, they can't afford it in the UK, and they do have some specific issues, are there any things that people can do to try and make an improvement, or would you just say that they do really need to get tested?
Yeah, so, certainly if you're concerned that you've got some kind of bacterial dysbiosis, you're concerned that you've got a parasite or some kind of overgrowth, don't dabble with that stuff, because that's half the problem that we're seeing is the problems that we're finding, these bad bugs, they're resistant to some of our known antimicrobials. And a really good way to create that resistance is by just dabbling with something, right? So when you look at our protocols, say we use Artemisia or sweet wormwood is one of the botanical herbs that we use to kill small protozoan microbes. And it's potentially, I don't know this for sure with every single organism, but you could potentially create a Artemisia resistant form of whatever protozoan is causing you problems by just buying a bottle from Amazon and taking half of it, deciding it wasn't doing anything, and then stopping. Do you see what I mean? So, you might be like throwing away a weapon from your armory for no reason. So I think it's better if you're not, if you can't afford to do the testing, it's like probably better to do nothing at all and just focus on the diet and the lifestyle stuff. And the diet and the lifestyle stuff is the foundation of it all anyway. Like, you can't just do the testing and take some supplements and carry on eating McDonald's and sleeping for 4 hours every night. Like, that's not going to work. And so, you're doing the hardest and most important part anyway. So, that's something to keep in mind.
Great.
Okay, well, that's all the questions that I had written down, so...
Perfect. I think we'll probably let you go, Chris, but why don't you... I know that you offer services to people even across the Atlantic, and you have a blog and your own podcast and all that. So why don't you tell people where they can find you and all that stuff?
Yeah, great. Thank you. I am helping other people achieve some of the same things that I've achieved. And I kind of cheated because my wife's a food scientist. So if you're just getting started on the paleo diet and you'd like some help with that, or if you know or think that the autoimmune protocol, you've looked into that and you think that that might help you, then it's really useful to have some assistance from a professional. So Julie's great for that. You can come to our website, nourishbalancethrive.com. Or if you're interested in the testing as well, I actually offer free consultations. So you'll end up speaking to either me or Julie, my wife, or the registered nurse. And you can talk to us for 15 minutes and we can figure out, whether you could benefit from any of the stuff that we're recommending. And then also my podcast, Wow, this is great. I get to talk about everything. Yeah, the podcast, I'm really, really having fun with this. So in the beginning, that was how I learned half of this stuff, was by listening to podcasts. And yeah, I find it much easier to talk than I do to write. And so I started my own podcast, and I've had some amazing experts. It's absolutely incredible. Like, you can, you know, write to someone who is the world's leading expert on ketogenic diets and say, will you come on my podcast and talk to me for an hour? And they say yes. And so, you know, I've been doing that loads. I mean, imagine it, if you were to like email Rob Wolf and say, will you spend one-on-one coaching, you know, an hour of your time coaching with me for nothing? He would say no. You will come onto your podcast. So that's what I've been doing. And the podcast then is really part of my continuing education. You know, I take the very best information from these experts who are, you know, at the frontier of their field from all over the world, and I repackage some of that information. It goes into our protocols. So, for example, Stefan Guillene is a neurobiologist that looks at the hyperpalatability of food and why people overeat. And we've been using some of his information, some of what he told me in for our clients that are trying to lose weight, and been getting great results with it. So yeah, it's cool. So yeah, nourishbalancedlife.com, and then you'll find the podcast. It's linked from the top of the page.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks very much, Chris. And if anybody's sort of listening to this on iTunes, just remember that you can find Chris at nourishbalancedthrive.com. Chloe is at paleo-britain.co.uk, and I am at Dr. Ragnar, that's drragnar.com. And you know, follow the podcast and let us know what you think. And as always, ask us any questions. Feel free to disagree with us, disagree with Chris. I think that's the way that we sort of start to learn more, and everybody can sort of figure out exactly where we're going with this. So thanks very much, guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Great.